everyone. My name's Anne, and I'm an alcoholic. I feel really tall up here. I'm like, hello, everyone. I just feel very tall. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober and in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight and with all of you. I want to welcome you if you're new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find here what I found here, and that's a great deal of peace, but it took a lot of work for me to get there, and it continues to take a lot of work for me to stay there. Thank you for your 10 minutes. I really identified with what you said. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Damien, for asking me to come here. I appreciate it. I'm really glad to be here. And everyone, thank you for being so welcoming to me when I got here. I really appreciate it. My sobriety date is May 29th, 2004. I have a sponsor named Karen, and my home group is Bellflower Big Book Group in Bellflower, California. It meets on Monday night at 7:30 p.m. If you're ever in the area, you're more than welcome to come. I would suggest you get there early, and if you can't find a seat, you can have mine. So, but you're welcome. Anyway, I'll just tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm trying to be like today. I was born and raised in Iowa. I'm the oldest of three children. I have a mom and a dad. You know, I grew up, my earliest memory is sitting in a wet diaper and irritated that the babysitter's not changing it. And I was really mad, and I told my mom I didn't want that babysitter anymore. And I'm sure I said it in a two-year-old voice or whatever, but that's my first memory. And so that was one of my dominant emotions as a young person, was I was highly agitated and irritated most of the time. And the other feeling I had as a young person was I was very fearful. And I only know this from doing my inventories in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was very scared of other kids at school. I'm born in August, and was much younger than my other classmates. And my mom said I was always very emotionally immature. I don't know if that's because of my age. But I was very fearful around social situations with other kids, and I would try to make people laugh and joke around, and I ended up having to stay after school a lot growing up because I got in trouble. And, you know, my relief came in eighth grade when I found alcohol. You know, and neither one of my parents are alcoholic. They drank sometimes, but I didn't know what alcoholism was, and they're both from North Carolina, so I wasn't around their family. We were kind of out there in Iowa by ourselves, and you know, I ended up having some friends over, and there was a fifth of Jose Cuervo that I uncapped, and my parents were gone, and I was supposed to be babysitting those brothers, and we started passing that bottle around, and I drank it out of the bottle. I never once thought to get a glass, and I just knew I was up to no good. That's all I knew, and I started drinking it, and kind of all that self-centered fear and thinking about myself all the time started just to ease away, and we started passing that bottle around, and as the effects of alcohol started to take over, I just breathed, you know, and then I was smiling, and I was like, yeah, and I was giggling, and then I engaged in some inappropriate behavior for an eighth grader, and then I locked myself in the guest bedroom, and I thought, you know what, this is my house and my booze, they need to find their own, and that's exactly what I thought, and I went and finished that bottle, because I thought the boys would drink it all, and so I finished it. And we were in the basement, and the next thing I know, my parents are home. It's 4 a.m, and my friends are gone, and I don't know where that bottle is. And I'm not thinking, wow, you lost a chunk of time there, Ann. And where did everyone go? And are your brothers alive that you're supposed to be babysitting for? And I woke up in some weird liquid on the floor. I don't know what it was. And, you know, I got away with it, and that's all I cared about, because my dad was not a timeout person, and it would have been bad. And so I got away with it, and I didn't start drinking every day at that point, but I drank when I could, you know, and it was weekends at first in Iowa, out in the field, we went camping, and, you know, I just kind of ended up wherever I was, you know. I'd always drank in excess. I never was a social drinker. Once I had one, I had another one, and then another one, and until I was laid out, you know, I'd black out and pass out, and that's kind of the story of my drinking. And I always gravitated towards hard liquor. Beer, I could drink a lot of beer and still be talking, and I didn't really appreciate that. And so I would always go and find the people that had the hard liquor. I'd go find the bikers that had the whiskey in their saddlebags, and I would drink that, and then I'd go to the keg at the high school party or whatever, you know. And then very early on, I had consequences. I had a reputation I didn't particularly want. My father was a physician in this community of 10,000, and I was the only daughter, and I was supposed to be the good girl, and I wasn't, and I embarrassed that family of mine. They didn't raise me to be that way, and, you know, I didn't care. really. I was very disrespectful. And I was about to graduate from high school, and my mom started saying things to me. She started saying, "Ann, you're a budding alcoholic. You're a budding alcoholic." And I said, "I have straight A's. What are you talking about? You know, I'm not going to listen to that." And, you know, they didn't let me into the National Honor Society until my very last semester. And I went up to the people on the committee, and I said, "Why did you guys wait? You know, I'm higher ranked in the class than the other people that got in." And their response to me was, "We were making sure you didn't get arrested." Yeah. Because everyone I hung out with did. And I just got away with it. And, you know, I ended up going to the University of Iowa. I started off as a biology pre-med major, and I got 3 D's and an F that first semester because I didn't go to class, you know. And my parents split up when I was about 16, and that's when I started to drink almost every day. And I know that there were days I didn't drink, but I drank almost every day until I got here. And, you know, my mom's dad had died from alcoholism, but I never met him because my mom was only 15 when that happened. He died from esophageal varices. He had surgery to fix it, but they had to do a blood transfusion, and he went into shock from the clean blood and died. And, you know, I went to his gravesite in North Carolina, and he's from a family of eight, and they're six of the eight are one of us. And, you know, we went to each of the gravesites of the siblings, and my mom's like, "This one died of cirrhosis, and so did her dog, because she drank with her dog," and you know, and I was like, "Oh, my family history," you know, and but I never knew what alcoholism was, because I just didn't see it up close and personal. I had one friend whose mother was, but I didn't know what it was. I thought I was drinking because I wanted to, and it made me feel better. It allowed me to be among you, and to be with you, and to socialize for at least 30 minutes before I went way past the mark. And it really wasn't my intention to do that. I just wanted to be there, but I just kept going past there. And then I would just be on the front porch face down, or in the living room face down, or in the middle of a field face down. And I was always the one that's like, "I'll be up in a minute," you know, and because I would just drink too much. And but I was just a pig out there, I guess. And so I graduated from college with a humanities degree with a very low GPA. And I moved to San Diego, California in 1998 because Iowa had become the problem. And I, you know, I'll just tell you how my thought process is with my drinking. I got pregnant twice in blackouts as a teenager. I stopped doing what causes you to get pregnant instead of looking at my drinking. I drank to such an extent one night in college, I was only 19, that I passed out from a high bar stool and smashed my head really hard on a wood floor and vomited for 3 days. So I'm pretty sure that was more than a hangover. I'm sure it was a concussion. And I said, "You know what? I'm not going to drink that vodka out of those cheap plastic bottles anymore." And it's that vodka. And I didn't drink vodka for like 2 years. And you know, I can't look at my drinking. You know, and so I knew something was wrong with me, and I blamed it a lot on the household I grew up in for a long time. And I started searching for a spiritual answer at a young age when I was in eighth grade. I'm from this town in Iowa where they do transcendental meditation, and so I learned how to do TM at a young age. Then I became a vegetarian, and then I started going to churches in college and rubbing olive oil on walls and speaking in tongues and drinking in the other hand, and God, Lord knows what I was saying. And then I got really suicidal when I was in college, and I went to a therapist, and they told me I was in a sophomore slump. I didn't tell them how much I was drinking, and they didn't ask. And so I thought, okay, that didn't work. And so the last thing I did was move to California. I thought, you know, Iowa is the problem. It's cold here 6 months out of the year. I have a really bad reputation. And my parents didn't fight me on it at all, you know. I got in the car. I was 21 years old. I got in my Ford Tempo. I had no cell phone. And I drove out here by myself. And my parents were basically like, "Don't let the door hit you." And, you know, and I stopped in Albuquerque and hung out with some friends at UNM. And I ended up going to Carlsbad when I first got here. My friend's uncle lived there, and he had cocktail hour every Friday in his garage. And so that's when I showed up. And we drank as soon as I parked my car, you know. And so I just took me with me, and that's what I did. And, you know, instead of coming to on a busy street in Iowa in a mud puddle wondering how I got there, and it's like 8 o'clock at night. It's not even late, and I'm already like that. And I come to with the ocean coming over me in Mission Beach, you know, and that'll wake you up. it's cold. And I didn't know that when I first moved here. I grew up going to beaches in the southeast because of my family, and I ran in the ocean when I first got here. It was so cold, but that has nothing to do with AA. So, sorry, I do that sometimes. Anyway, so I came out here to go to more schooling, and I thought that if I got a career and kind of straightened up and flew right and got it together, that I would be okay, because I was really just partying and having fun, or so I thought, you know. And by this time, I don't have a lot of friends anymore. I kind of run all my friends down, you know, and I had a lot of friends express concern to me over the years that they thought the way I was living my life was destructive, you know, and they were concerned about me. And I said, well, there's the door, you know, figuratively, you can leave my life. And so when I moved to California, there weren't a lot of people that really were staying in touch with me. And so I ended up going to more schooling out here and in San Diego, and I passed a test to do what I do in California and ended up moving to Orange County. And that was the beginning of the end of my drinking. And basically, I wasn't going out very much and socializing because it was just too dangerous for me. And I was not a safe drinker. I couldn't. My window of time of holding it together around other people was just getting smaller and smaller. And I ended up going home and drinking on the floor of my furnitureless apartment. My thought was, if I drink on the floor, I can't fall off. I'm already there. And because I just wasn't safe. I mean, it was really my thinking. I was just trying not to hurt others or myself, but I needed to drink no matter what. And so I would drink vodka on the floor and crawl to my room or just stay in the living room because no one wants to be around me at this point. And I would either go to work still drunk or very hungover, and sometimes I'd puke down the end of the hallway, the bathroom, and come back, and I'd shut my door acting like I was busy, but I had my head on my desk. And somewhere along the line, I found DayQuil. I don't know why. I drank DayQuil in the morning. I would drink a bottle of DayQuil and a pot of coffee and a bag of Hershey's chocolates. It was like I was trying to cure my hangover or something. I don't know what, but it helped me feel better. And so I don't know why I did that. So I wouldn't drink at work, and this is how my head would go. I'm like, I need a drink. It'd be 8 in the morning. I need a drink. I need vodka. Why can't you drink at work? I hate America. I'm moving to Canada. I don't know why I'm talking about it. And this is how my head would go, you know. This is what my head would do. And, you know, my coworker would say, hey, we're going to go get martinis across the street. I hit the power button, not hit save. Just go. And on a good night, I'd get off that bar stool, drive on the 405, and go drink at home. And on most nights, I ended up not being able to get off that bar stool. And, you know, people were commenting on how I smelled at work because I reeked of booze all the time. And because I wasn't drinking at work, I was not a nice person to be around. I was either still drunk from the night before or detoxing at work every day. And I had secretaries quitting on me saying I was psychotic and unpredictable and other things that I'm not going to say from the podium. And I worked in a business environment, and I would throw files across the room, and then I would slam the door, and I would other people that I was doing business with on the phone, they would say things, and I'm like, if you don't get this, blank, 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 blah, 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 and I just scream and slam the phone down. I don't do that today, and I haven't done that since I got sober. I can still have a fit, but not at work, you know? So that behavior will get you called into your administrator's office. And so my administrator was saying, you know, Ann, we like the work that you do, the product, but we think you might need a psychiatrist. And they're like, we think you might need medication. And that's what they were saying to me. And I was like, you can't tell me what to do, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I didn't notice my drinking until about, it was November before I got sober in May, however far long that is. And what happened was I went out with a friend I had gone to school with. She asked if I wanted to go to Woodland Hills with her, and then we went to Hollywood. And she wanted to meet some guys she was dating, and they had a bunch of money, and they were in these fancy cars. And we went to these fancy Hollywood clubs, and I can't seem to talk to them long enough. I keep having to go back to the bar and get more and more, and all of a sudden the house lights come on. And I'm like, we all have to do a shot of vodka. And nobody wanted none. So I'm like, I'll do them all. And I did them all. And because I get nervous if the alcohol is going to go away. I get really nervous. And the next thing I know, we're on the 101, and I start puking all over. It was a Mercedes, actually. And I held my head out the window on the 101, and then I puked all over their car. And there were five of us in that car. And I just noticed that I was the only one puking. And honestly, that's not a different night other than any other night for me. But I noticed it for some reason. I'm like, you're 27 years old. And nobody else is puking but you. And I was really embarrassed by that. And I just wanted, I put my head down and I wanted to go home. And my friend, I was driving a little Ford Focus at the time. And my friend had to drive my car home because I wasn't very conscious. And, you know, I knew I'd thrown up holding my head out of my car, but I didn't realize I'd thrown up in my car until like sobriety and months later. And I went to trade my car in and the whole passenger side of the seat was eaten away by vomit. And I was like, oh, I didn't know I did that. Anyway, so... anyway, and then so I started to notice my drinking. That's when I started to notice it. And so that was when my kind of chapter 3 experiment started. And I tried 2 different experiments before I got sober. And the first one was I tried to have Diet Cokes between my martinis. And I never drank a Diet Coke. And the reason being is I started with a martini. And once I put alcohol into my body, our book talks about developing the phenomenon of craving. And that's what happened to me. And a Diet Coke sounds like a stupid idea. And I just want another one and another one. And then I'm making a fool of myself again. And the last thing I tried before I got sober is I tried not to drink Monday through Wednesday. That was my big goal. If I could make it till Thursday, that's acceptable in my mind. And I couldn't get past Monday. And I was 27, and I couldn't not drink on a Monday. And I was really scared. I'm like, this is not good. You're going down, you know? And my big battle cry was I had a job, and I just felt really bad, you know? And the thing that was also happening was, in addition to losing friends and not paying bills and all the other stuff that we do, is I was getting very dark inside. All that light was going out, and I was feeling really depressed and very lonely and very sad and very much like I didn't want to be walking on the earth anymore. And I was very serious about that, and I wasn't telling anyone. And I just thought, you know, I did everything you're supposed to do. I went to church. I learned how to meditate. I exercised like a mad woman, you know. I went and got this degree and have this income and have this title, and nothing works, you know. And there's honestly nothing wrong with any of those things. But for me, they're not sufficient treatment for my alcoholism. I had to come here, you know, to treat my alcoholism. And I didn't know that till I did it. But so... the last night I drank, you know, I'm telling you how I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking and I'm failing miserably at all attempts. I drove home in a blackout one last time on the 405. By this time I'm living with a friend of mine in Lakewood because I have not paid my bills enough where I have to move in with someone. And she went to school with me and she let me live there. And, you know, I came to the next day and I thought, I can't do this anymore. I just can't live this way anymore. And I don't know where that came from. I look at it now as the grace of a loving God or my higher power, whatever you want to call it. But I know, looking back, I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And this was a Saturday. It was May 29th, 2004. And I knew I had to get busy really fast. And I ended up going to the Lakewood Public Library. And I was going to get a biography because I didn't even like to read, but I just thought I'd do that. And I was probably about 30 pounds heavier than I am right now. I was very, very bloated. The white parts of my eyes were very yellow. In fact, my good friend who I had dinner with tonight, she lives in Chula Vista. We've been friends since 8th grade. She's from Iowa, too, and lives down there. And when I got sober, I went and visited her in Japan, where her husband's in the Navy. They were stationed over there. And she said, I've never seen your eyes look that white in your life. And she's like, that's amazing. And, you know, because we've known each other since we were 14, about when I started drinking. And so, my face was very red. And so I went to the Lakewood Public Library. I found myself standing in the aisle on alcoholism. And I didn't mean to be standing there. And so I got books on alcohol dependency, alcohol abuse, all these different books, because I thought I might have the beginnings of a possible drinking problem, and that's where my head was saying. And because I had a job, you know, that was my battle cry. I have a job. I should be fine. And I went home, and I started to read these books, and I was fitting all the categories of alcohol abuse and alcohol dependency, and just all the categories, and it scared me. So I thought, I better go to work. And I went to work, and I threw those books aside, and my boss, I had a boss at the time, he's 20 years sober at the time. He's still sober in our program. Steve, my secretary, was sober 5 years. And she had broke Steve's anonymity to me. He allows me to say his name from the podium. She broke his anonymity to me previously. I wonder why. I also need to tell you, my aunt is sober in Hawaii. She was sober 20 years. She's still sober. I'm going to go see her next month to celebrate her 29th. And I met her a year before I got sober. And I was really drunk when I met her. She was visiting L.A. to visit some of her friends, probably in the program, who knows. And I was drinking. And I was like, is this bothering you? And she's like, no, it's good. So I need to tell you, I don't drink for 6 weeks and I don't go to AA for 6 weeks. But when I went to work that day, my boss, Steve, walked in, and I thought I was doing the right thing that day. I wasn't going to tell him I wasn't drinking because he'd probably come at me with a big book. But I just, you know, knew I was doing the right thing. I took it as a little sign. And I don't drink for 6 weeks. I don't go to AA for 6 weeks. And I detox at home. And those are probably the worst 6 weeks of my life so far. I didn't understand what was physically happening to my body. I knew that my hangovers had gotten really bad, and I was very, very sick and shaky and very, very sick until I drank again. But I drank every day, so it would always stop once I started drinking. But I didn't understand what was happening to me when I detoxed. And I started to sweat through all my sheets at night. I was very shaky for a couple days. I was gripping onto my mattress. My feet were rubbing together really fast, and my head was racing. I had these racing thoughts really bad, and I couldn't sleep. And if you're new and you're having trouble sleeping, I want you to know I didn't sleep right for about 4 months. And it doesn't mean I didn't sleep, but I'd be up for 3 nights and then sleep for 4 days and then up. You know, it was just all over the place. And eventually it ironed itself out. So there is hope. And so anyway, I just was kind of freaking out. And at the end of that 6 week period, I started to cry myself to sleep at night. And I thought, I can't drink and I can't not drink. I'm going to have to blow my brains out in the backyard. And I didn't know that that's in our big book. I didn't have a big book. I just knew that I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink. Stopping drinking made it worse. It amplified the problem because I didn't have the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you that during that 6 week period, my aunt was calling me every day from Honolulu, and she was saying things like, honey, normal drinkers don't go into a blackout every time they drink. And I said, well, if you drank as much hard liquor as I did, you would. And that was my response. I'm like, what do you mean? And I just didn't see it. I just couldn't see. And she was just calling me, checking on me. And the only good thing that happened during that period of time was that I lost some weight just simply by not drinking the amounts that I was drinking. And I don't really know how much that was. It was just enough to make me black out and pass out every day. And I'm sure it varied. But my boss, Steve, noticed I looked different. And he said, Ann, what are you doing? You look good. Are you working out? What's going on? And my coworker Gary came flying out of his office, and he said, that's because Ann stopped drinking. And I was like, and, you know, I'm 6 weeks dry, so I'm not happy. And I'm thinking about ending my life, and I'm not telling anyone. And I was like, thanks for the public service announcement, Gary. We appreciate it. And, you know, my boss didn't do anything at first. He just kind of watched me, and he would say, how's the not going with nobody looking? And I was like, I don't know. And I was just getting more depressed. And he eventually came into my office and shut the door, and that's when my journey here began. And it was one alcoholic talking to another. And he said, you know, Ann, this might be the only window open in the cosmos for you to walk through to get sober. And I suggest you walk through it. And, you know, I had that diet coke failed experiment. I had the failed Monday through Wednesday experiment, and I believed him. I didn't know why I stopped drinking that day other than the grace of God. I don't know what happened, you know. And he said, you have to go to Santa Barbara for work tomorrow. Why don't you listen to this CD? And I said, okay. And he didn't tell me if it was music, what it was. I didn't know it was an AA speaker. And so I put it in, and it was Sister Maurice from the Bronx. And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous taught her to what thine own self be true really means, and to love thy neighbor as thyself, not instead of thyself. And those concepts, in addition to her story, really resonated with me. And I laughed, and I cried, and I loved it. And I didn't understand that I was identifying in my car by myself with an AA speaker. But I brought it back to Steve the next day when I came back into the office. I said, hey, can I have another CD? Because I thought, I don't need your meetings. I'll just do CDs, and I'll be good. And because I thought, you know, because I felt some relief from hearing that. And instead, what Steve said was, why don't you go to a meeting with my friend Lisa? And I said, okay. And, you know, when your boss tells you you go to AA, you just do it. And because I need to have a job. And so I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a beginner's meeting on Monday night, 15th and Balboa in Newport Beach. She knew everyone, and they all came up to me smiling and put their hands out and tried to welcome me. But I was kind of this body language, You know, I hadn't had a drink in 6 weeks. I don't know what AA is. I remember thinking everyone looked really happy and good, and I was a little surprised that people were happy to be here. You know, I was like, what's there to be happy about? Because I wasn't happy about anything. And, you know, I didn't stand up as a newcomer and say I'm an alcoholic. I was just checking it out. I wasn't sure. So if you are new to these rooms and you're trying to figure out if you're alcoholic, I want to welcome you, because that was me. You know, and nobody pressured me into it. I came here and I was searching. And so she got me my first big book that night. And what happened was different people came up to the podium and shared. And I remember identifying with them, and the hair on the back of my neck stood up. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm an alcoholic. This is what's been wrong with me my whole life. And at the same time, I had that overwhelming gratitude and just kind of aha moment. I thought, oh God, I'm an alcoholic. That means I have to go to these stupid meetings and do these stupid steps. I'm going to go get the gun at Walmart like my original plan and go blow my brains out. And, you know, and Lisa said, meet me at another meeting and meet me at another meeting and meet me at another meeting. And I just kept following her around, because my next step after AA is kill self. So I just kept following her. And, you know, because that really, this was the last house on the block for me, literally. And so... And I'm not saying kill myself lightly, because that happens around here, you know, and I've known people that that's happened to. And anyway, so eventually I stood up and I said, I'm Ann and I'm an alcoholic. And I cried and I choked those words out, because I knew the gig was up and I'd have to do something. And for some reason at the time, I was working in Orange County but living in Lakewood. And they said, you know what, you live close to Bellflower. Why don't you go to Bellflower Big Book and ask for Karen or Johnny? And I said, okay. And I don't know Bellflower from any other meeting. I've been in AA 2 whole weeks at this point. So I go up to Monday night. It's a very large meeting, like this very nice meeting is. And I said, hey, I'm Ann or Karen or Johnny here. And they just pointed. And I was like, okay. And I walked over and I said, hey, Karen, I'm Ann. Lisa sent me. And she told me 2 years later she had no idea who I was. And I said, And she said, do you have a sponsor? And I don't even really know what a sponsor is, but I just said no. And she's like, great, I'm going to be your sponsor. Get in the greeting line. And I was like, okay. And I just followed her direction. You know, I didn't know any better. And the meeting was over. She says, call me at 7:30 in the morning tomorrow. And I was like, okay. And then when I called her, she's like, tomorrow call me at 7:30 with a gratitude list. So I started doing that. And she's like, do you have a 24-hour day book? She gets me a 24-hour day book. So I start reading that. And, you know, I'm just doing what she says, and I'm not doing it because I'm happy to do it, but I just don't know any different. And she had me go into meetings every day. I had to get there a half hour early, stay late, introduce myself to the new girl. She was like, you can help someone who has 1 day if you have 2 days. I'm like, whatever. And, I mean, my attitude was really bad my first year, really bad. I was so angry. And I'd be in that greeting line every Monday, no matter what. And some Mondays I'd be like, welcome to Bellflower. And I'd be really nice. And some Mondays I'd be like, what's up? And I was mean. And then one time I'd be crying like crazy. Like, oh, come to the meeting. And they're just like, yeesh. And, you know, like, I just wasn't a very good example, is my point. Now in sobriety, I try to keep my personal problems on that phone call with my sponsor. And I try to practice the principles in the rooms and try to be an example in the rooms. And leave that other stuff out there. And if I'm having a real bad day, I don't lie about it. I'll just say I've had better days, but I'm not going to unload when I'm trying to help someone here. Anyway, what's my point? So I have this sponsor, and she's taking me through the steps as it's outlined in the big book. And, you know, I'm very, very angry, and people are commenting about my behavior to my sponsor, and they're saying, you know what? We think she might need medication. She's very angry. We think she needs outside help. And I'm very grateful to my sponsor, and I really do not have an opinion on that outside issue. Thank you. My sponsor said, you know what, we're going to try the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if that doesn't work, we'll think about doing something else. And I'm really grateful she did that, because the steps worked for me. I really am an alcoholic, and I just have to keep doing it. And so I went through those steps, like she said. I got in a big fight with her the day I did my fifth step. I'm like, I don't trust you, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm just an example of someone you can stay sober despite yourself if you just do the action, because I was not nice. But from doing the steps, I've become nicer. You know, I'm more at peace. I'm more comfortable in my skin. There are days when I'm not as comfortable as others, but most of the time I feel good. I had to make amends. Let me back up. When I did my inventory, where we saw our faults or where we had made a mistake, a lot of people call it my part, I never wrote dishonesty down ever. And my sponsor had me use a different color pen and write down dishonesty over and over again. And I'm someone that lies by omission, I learned from reading my fifth step. And this is what's so valuable about a sponsor. She pointed something out I couldn't see at all. You know, I need someone else to help me run my life. Or not me run my life, help me with my life, you know, turn my will and my life over the care of God. And so, anyway, I lie by omission. How that looks is I won't ever tell anyone what's really going on with me. I act like everything's okay, use me, do whatever. And I hold it in and I build a resentment and I drink over it. And I didn't know that that was going on. And so I had to make amends. And, you know, I thought my family would be relatively easy. My mom, there's a part in my amends, how my sponsor had me do it, where I say, if there's anything else I'm forgetting, please let me know that too. My mom had a laundry list. I was like, and we're very close, but she just went off on me. Remember when you stole this from the house? And I said, okay. And then I had to pay $14,000 back in credit card debt, which took me 4.5 years to do, and that was fun. But it's done. But the one that made that was difficult was my dad. My dad and I were pretty estranged from one another for many years and for various reasons. And my sponsor had me do that amend a little different. She said, you know, I want you to call your dad and ask if you can start calling him once a week at a time convenient for him. I sat on that direction for 3 months and got into a lot of pain. And in Target one night, I called my dad and I said, Dad, this is Ann. May I please start calling you at a time convenient for you once a week? And I held my breath because years prior to that, before I got sober, I tried to reach out to my dad and it was an unfavorable response. And so I was very scared to approach him again. And he said, I would love that. And so I believe that there's healing in God's time, you know, and he was ready for it and I was ready for it. And so I started calling my dad once a week and it was awkward at first, but I kept doing it. And there were periods of time where I would just leave a voicemail and I would tell my sponsor, I don't want to keep doing this. He's not calling back. She goes, it doesn't matter what he's doing. It matters what you're doing. Be consistent. Click. And I was like, ugh. And, you know, and so I was able to go see him on Thanksgivings. He was living in Oregon at the time. And a few years ago, he had some very bad health problems where I didn't think he was going to make it. And I got to be a daughter. You know, we are so tight now. I got to be a daughter, and I got to send encouragement cards, and I got to call him more than once a week. And I would have these weird intuitions at work, and I would call my father, and he would say, I really needed that right now, you know. And that's not me. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my higher power working in my life, you know. And I wouldn't have even had that relationship. I wouldn't have even known he was going through what he was going through if it wasn't for the amends. And I'm so grateful for that. And then the other thing I like to share about is I have a very good friend of mine who I got back into my life. And I didn't get all my friends back in my life. I tried to approach some friends and they want nothing to do with me because of the way I treated them. And that's okay. But this one friend of mine, Sarah, lives in Kansas City. And she kept wanting me to come visit her. And I was like, no, you know, I don't want to go to Missouri on my time off. And I was very selfish about it. And she said, so finally, her birthday is May 31st. My sobriety date's May 29th. And I said, I'll come for Memorial Day weekend a couple years ago. And I was six and I was about to turn seven. And she's like, that's great, you know. And right before I went over there, she said, you know, Ann, I want to ask you something. And I said, okay. And she said, would you be Evan's godmother, her second son? And I told you about those pregnancies as a teenager. That's why I tell that part of my story. And I was like, me, a godmother, you know? And I said, sure, I would be honored. And I didn't realize that it was going to break my heart open, you know? And the tears started coming. And I had kind of done some step work on it, but I was kind of pushing it away. And I started crying, and I got on that flight, and it was a Frontier airline, and it had a mama cub and a baby cub on the wing. It was like Lola and Max. And I was like, ah! And so I flew out there, and you know, I couldn't have planned this. It's my AA birthday, and I'm standing in the church holding this little baby, Evan, and becoming a godmother on my seventh AA birthday. And just these waves of emotion came over me, you know, because I didn't know that was possible other than doing what we do here, you know. And like I said, my sponsor had me working with new girls right off the bat, going to panels, reaching my hand out, reading the big book. And that's the brightest spot in my life today is passing it on. That's all I'm here to do at this point, you know, pass it on and to try and to continue to enlarge in my spiritual life, you know. And I started sponsoring at 6 months, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I just had them do what I did with my sponsor. And then I would call my sponsor, now what do I say, you know. And that's all I do today. And I still do the same things that I did when I got sober with prayer and meditation and, you know, going to regular meetings, getting there early, having commitments, having some literature-based meetings because the solution's in the book. If you're new and you don't have a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't leave here without one. And if you don't have the financial means to get one, come see me and we'll make sure you get one. Anyway, and then from doing the program Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time to the best of my ability, I have a very, very deep sense of peace. And I was single for a long time, and about a year ago I met someone, and it's been an amazing trip. And we'll see where it goes. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that either. That's not why I came here. I came here to get sober, and that's it. And, you know, life continues to unfold. And, you know, even though I tell you I have peace, I don't want you to believe that my life's all perfect and happy-go-lucky. And, you know, I do have a very good life. But, you know, that aunt who 12-stepped me, she got breast cancer a few years ago. And, you know, she's in remission right now a couple years. And then I moved to Garden Grove a little over a year ago because my friend bought a house on a short sale, and it was a really nice house, and she wanted to rent a room out to me, and I was going to save some money that way. And we were like, yay, everything's perfect. And 2 weeks later, she got diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer, and she's a member of our program. And, you know, she's taught me how to walk through something with grace and dignity. She's taught me what matters. You know, I thought I was going to be there for her, but it's been the other way around, you know. And she's finished treatment, and we'll see what happens. And, you know, I've had to go to a lot of memorial services here in the program, but that's because I get close to people and I let people in today. You know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really want to welcome you. And if you've been here a while and you're suffering, please talk to someone before you leave tonight. And because I have found I can get very spiritually sick in sobriety when I hold things in and I don't tell somebody what's going on. And I'm sure I've come very close a couple times in my sobriety where I may not have been here tonight had I not reached out, you know. Anyway, thank you for listening to me, and I hope that you all have a long and happy life, and stay sober. Thanks.